Chapter 14. Gardening Eden. Further intriguing hints that some sort of intelligent, guided project was mounted in the Amazon thousands of years ago are to be found in recent studies of the species of trees that populate the rainforest. These studies demonstrate that far from being a pristine natural environment, the Amazon is largely a human creation. Anna Roosevelt, whose sometimes radical views we've already encountered, criticizes other scientists for assuming all too often that the Amazon's forests are entirely works of nature, without conducting research to exclude a human influence. When that research is done, it turns out that while Amazonian forests in different regions differ significantly from one another in topography, climate, geology, hydrology, structure, seasonality, and history, they nonetheless often resemble each other in showing a pattern of unexpected dominance and density of a small group of plant species. This pattern has been found wherever Amazonian forests have been inventoried and has yet to be explained by natural factors. The best current estimate is that the Amazon is presently home to about 16,000 woody tree species. Out of this total, however, only 227 hyperdominant species dominate Amazonian forests. These so-called oligarchs, from the Greek for rule by a few, make up only 1.4% of all the Amazon forest species, but almost half of the trees in any given forest. In 2017, a large international team of ecologists and archaeologists, led by environmental science researcher Carolina Leavis of Wageningen University in the Netherlands, completed a study looking into this peculiar pattern of distribution. What immediately stood out in their data was that among the oligarchs, domesticated species are 5 times more likely than non-domesticated species to be hyperdominant. Moreover, in almost every case where clusters of hyperdominants were inventoried, ancient archaeological sites were found among them, a correlation so frequent and reliable that the presence and concentration of oligarchs could, in theory, be used to predict the occurrence of archaeological sites in Amazonian forests. The team's detailed analysis, published in Science, therefore concludes that modern tree communities in Amazonia are structured to an important extent by a long history of plant domestication by Amazonian peoples. Detecting the widespread effect of ancient societies in modern forests strongly refutes ideas of Amazonian forests being untouched by man. Domestication shapes Amazonian forests. We've seen that the question of exactly when human beings first arrived in the Amazon remains to be settled. So, too, does the question of exactly when they began to domesticate trees. The team's results suggest that past human interventions had an important and lasting role in the distribution of domesticated species found in modern forests, despite the fact that the location of many archaeological sites is unknown. On present evidence, however, adds Leavis, all that can be said with certainty is that at some point, more than 8,000 years ago, Amazonian people were already focusing attention on certain trees that were particularly useful to them. They really cultivated and planted these species in their home gardens, in the forests they were managing. Among the favored species mentioned in the Science paper, now all hyperdominant, are Bertholletia excelsa, the Brazil nut tree, Inga edulis, ice cream bean, a fruit tree, Puruma sacropifolia, Amazon grape, a fruit tree, Puteria caimito, the abiu, a fruit tree, and Theobroma cacao, the coca tree, chocolate. Other prized Amazonian species domesticated in ancient times include the acai palm and tucuma palm, the peach palm, the cupuachu tree, the cashew tree, and the rubber tree. A major center for crop domestication. As I researched this material, I was initially surprised to learn that coca trees and rubber trees, both of which I'd wrongly believed were indigenous to and had been domesticated in Mexico, were in fact originally South American species and had been domesticated in the Amazon. I was equally surprised to learn that capsicum, chili peppers, red and green bell peppers, etc., which I had again wrongly thought were Mexican in origin, had likewise first been domesticated in the Amazon. Indeed, though often overlooked, Amazonia has rightly been described as a major center of crop domestication on a global scale. Prior to the European conquest, according to Charles R. Clement of Brazil's National Institute of Amazonian Research, at least 83 native species were domesticated to some degree, including manioc, sweet potato, cacao, tobacco, pineapple, and hot peppers, as well as numerous fruit trees and palms, and at least another 55 imported neotropical species were cultivated. Pineapples. There was another surprise for me, as I had, again wrongly, always assumed that these tropical fruits grow on trees and had their origins in some Pacific archipelago, perhaps Hawaii. In fact, the pineapple plant with its long spiky leaves is not a tree. It grows close to the ground, with each plant producing a single pineapple, belongs to the bromeliad family, and is indigenous to and was first domesticated in the Amazon rainforest. There is no firm information on when domestication was undertaken, but in Charles Clements's view, the widespread distribution of the pineapple in the Americas at the time of the European conquest, the diversity and quality of the cultivars not surpassed after one century of modern intensive breeding, the diversity of uses, the economic and cultural importance of the crop, all point to a very ancient domestication. Out of the 83 crops native to Amazonia and the 55 exotic ones, a total of 138 crops in all, Clements and his colleagues classify 52, including the pineapple, as fully domesticated. Of these, 14, 27%, are fruit or nut trees or woody vines. Among the 41 crops classified as semi-domesticated, 35, or 87%, are fruit or nut trees or woody vines. Among the 45 crops classified as incipiently domesticated, all but one are fruit or nut trees. Overall, 68% of these Amazonian crops are trees or woody perennials. In landscapes largely characterized by forest, a predominance of tree crops is perhaps not surprising. Nonetheless, the most important subsistence crop domesticated in Amazonia is an herbaceous shrub, manioc, and several other domesticates are also root or tuber crops, most of which are adapted to savanna forest transitional ecotones with pronounced dry seasons. Think of it. The rainforest was coaxed, shaped, and transformed by what can only be described as scientific practices into a vast garden of useful and productive trees. But trees alone cannot feed large populations, so the prehistoric domestication program was extended on a massive scale to include agricultural species that were then successfully incorporated through the use of terra preta into the Amazonian ecology. The manioc conundrum. Manioc, the key staple, the most important food crop that originated in Amazonia, and on which the majority of the population of the Amazon still depend today, is of particular interest for a number of reasons. Molecular analysis has confirmed that this woody shrub, cultivated for its edible roots, was domesticated in the Amazon basin, most likely in the savannas, the Brazilian Cerrado, to the south of the Amazon rainforest, and more specifically in northern Mato Grosso, Rondônia, and Acre states in Brazil, and adjacent areas of northern Bolivia. Domestication must have started before 8,000 years before the present, as that is the earliest date reported from the Zana and Nanachoc valleys of coastal Peru. Unlike the Amazon itself, large parts of which remain inaccessible to archaeologists, these two coastal Peruvian valleys have been well studied, yielding, as well as manioc, evidence for radiocarbon-dated human cultivation of squash, 9,240 and 7,660 years before the present, peanut, 7,840 years before the present, quinoa, 8,000 and 7,500 years before the present, and cotton, 5,490 years before the present. What is notable, however, is that all of these crops had already been domesticated elsewhere before being grown in coastal Peru. As with coca and chilies, I'd long been under the impression that the squash plant, cucurbita, was first domesticated in Mexico around 10,000 years ago, and indeed there is archaeological evidence to support this. But now here it was turning up in Peruvian coastal valleys 9,240 years ago, and not only there, but at similar dates in the nearby sites of Paján and Las Pircas. An authoritative study published in Science suggests that these cultivated Peruvian squash plants may have been from a line that had originally been domesticated not in Mexico, but in southwestern Ecuador and the Colombian Amazon as early as 10,000 to 9,300 years ago. What about the peanuts cultivated in the Zana and Nanachoc valleys 7,840 years ago? They too, it turns out, were domesticated east of the Andes, in a region extending south from the southern edge of the Amazon basin. This is broadly the same region in which manioc was also domesticated, and in both cases, we can only go on the dates of the earliest surviving materials, currently put at around 8,000 years before the present, to guess when domestication in fact took place. Certainly, it was before 8,000 years ago, but how long before is a matter largely of conjecture, and some authorities are already seeking to push the horizon back to at least 9,000 and perhaps 10,000 years ago. Manioc, also known as cassava, is a starchy crop, a good staple, providing almost twice as many calories as potatoes weight for weight. But it is also so low in protein content that, as one specialist warns, in manioc-dominated diets, protein deficiency can lead to malnutrition and also aggravate symptoms related to manioc cyanogenic toxicity. We'll return to that issue of toxicity in a moment, but let's note, meanwhile, that peanuts have a very high protein content that makes them a perfect nutritional complement to starchy manioc-based diets. Several authorities have noticed the pairing of the two in ancient cultures, and British botanist Barbara Pickersgill speculates that the wide prehistoric distribution of peanut cultivation may have accompanied the spread and uptake of manioc. Again, I can't help but wonder if there might not have been something more active and intentional at work behind the scenes of this process than mere accompanying. What I have in mind is the possibility that a deep knowledge of plants and of their nutritional and other properties might have preceded the first domestication activities that we have evidence for. Surely it is only on the basis of such foreknowledge that crops like groundnuts and manioc could be selected, domesticated, planned, and planted to complement each other's nutritional contribution to human welfare. This is pure speculation, of course, but it strengthens somewhat by the curious nature of the manioc roots themselves, which, although there are many varieties, are classified into two main categories, bitter and sweet. All contain compounds known as cyanogenic glucosides, found in low concentrations in the less popular sweet varieties and very high concentrations in the greatly prized and more widely used bitter varieties. The need-to-know element here is that if you eat any of the bitter varieties without first processing them in the correct way, extracting the glucosides, you will at least suffer from cyanic intoxication, with symptoms like vomiting, dizziness, and paralysis, if not die of cyanide poisoning. Ignorant of this, several of the soldiers on Francisco de Orellana's 16th century voyage down the Amazon ate unprocessed manioc roots. They survived, but became mightily sick, near to death as a result. To avoid poisoning, they would have had to peel the roots, then grate them, then strain and press the resulting mash to remove the hydrocyanic acid, and at last toast it to produce a fine, faintly yellowish flour. Simple, but absolutely essential procedures that the indigenous peoples of the Amazon have followed for thousands of years to make bitter manioc safe. The fundamental question, however, is exactly how and when this processing system was first devised. Obviously, since we have evidence of the cultivation of domesticated manioc by 8,000, or perhaps even as much as 10,000 years ago, it follows that the ability to process it must already have been developed by then. It would make no sense to anybody to go to all the trouble of domesticating a species and then growing crops from that species that nobody could eat without getting horribly and perhaps lethally sick. That's why I keep coming back to the haunting possibility that some person or group of people with an interest in the Amazon already understood the potentials of manioc and the exact steps that would have to be taken to avoid its dangers long before they ever chose to domesticate it and put it under cultivation. Otherwise, frankly, why bother? Plant gnosis. The manioc issue looks simple. You just need to peel it, grate it, soak it, strain it, and meticulously cook it to remove the poison, and it is transformed into a useful staple. All steps of the processing seem rather obvious and basic in retrospect, but consider the amount of trial and error, the number of volunteers you would have had to make sick or kill before you arrived at the right method. And what would motivate you to start such a project in the first place, unless you already knew the potential of the wild progenitor that would eventually become domesticated manioc? The same problem looms on an even larger and more complex scale with other plants of the Amazon, the uses to which they are put, and the processing they require. Anthropologist Jeremy Narby, author of The Cosmic Serpent, DNA and the Origins of Knowledge, draws attention to curare, the blowgun and arrow poison, invented, we do not know when, in the ancient Amazon. It produces paralysis and death by asphyxiation as the muscles required for breathing cease to function. It is used, Narby explains, because it kills tree-born animals without poisoning their meat while causing them to relax their grip and fall to the ground. Monkeys, when hit with an untreated arrow, tend to wrap their tails around branches and die out of the archer's reach. A very useful hunting aid, therefore, and one, moreover, that has been adopted into modern medical anesthesiology. But the real mystery, as Narby goes on to show us, is how it was ever invented in the first place. The consensus among scholars is that curare, of which there are 40 types in the Amazon made from 70 plant species, was stumbled upon by chance experimentation. Narby doubts this scenario. To produce it, it is necessary to combine several plants and boil them for 72 hours while avoiding the fragrant but mortal vapors emitted by the broth. The final product is a paste that is inactive unless injected under the skin. If swallowed, it has no effect. It is difficult to see how anybody could have stumbled on this recipe by chance experimentation. The whole mystery of the Amazonian plant medicines, notably the vision-inducing brew ayahuasca, which itself is a mixture of several plants that are most unlikely to have been fortuitously brought together, is explored in depth in my 2005 book, Supernatural, Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind. In these medicines, as in curare, as in Terra Preta, and as in the incredible burst of domestication of plants and trees in the Amazon that followed the end of the Ice Age, could we be looking at the cultural DNA not only of a civilization, but of a sophisticated civilization that had developed sciences of its own that it began to share with other people, very much including the peoples of the Amazon basin, around the time that the last Ice Age came cataclysmically to an end? Judging from the clues that lie scattered like tantalizing jewels across the Amazon, this hypothetical lost science of a hypothetical lost civilization would have looked very different from any of our own sciences, employing not only empirical methods, but also shamanistic techniques, vision quests, and out-of-body encounters in the spirit world that most modern Western intellectuals would regard as absurd. Again, however, if we go by the evidence of the Amazon, the plain fact is that the remnants and borrowings of this supposedly laughable form of science have again and again produced practical and down-to-earth results, domesticating and processing huge numbers of plants and trees, for example, or creating miracle soils that are still fertile after thousands of years of use, or inventing muscle relaxants like curare that inhibit acetylcholine receptors at the neuromuscular junction. Moreover, unlike Western technology, to which the earth is a dead thing, this ancient technology addresses all the needs, spiritual as well as physical, of the human creature. Again, though the skeptics will scoff, none of the many thousands of people who've had their lives transformed by ayahuasca in the past 20 years would deny that something very powerful and very hard to explain is at work here.